Today is March the 3rd, 2021. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm streaming on the internet. Podcasts of the program is also available on prn.fm on the internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Fry's Electronics is shutting its doors for good. Fry's Electronics, one of the last big brick-and-mortar electronics store chains in the United States, and a Silicon Valley institution in particular, is permanently closing nationwide. The company's Facebook page is also gone, and its Twitter feed has been set to private. Whenever I am visiting the Silicon Valley area, I always made it a point of visiting Fry's at Palo Alto and Campbell. Going to a Fry store was entertainment in itself. The company's Black Friday doorbusters were a Silicon Valley event with lines around the block for $200 laptop and $60 routers. Even before the COVID-19 pandemic, the family-owned business had been pushed to the brink of extinction by online retailers like Amazon and Newegg. In response, the company started a campaign to price match any item you could find online. By 2019, warehouses were filled with empty shelves. The company had been forced to switch to a consignment model, only able to track suppliers willing to get paid for their goods after Fry's is able to manage to sell them. Samsung stopped doing business due to unpaid bills, and that Fry's had eliminated most of their full-time staff even before the pandemic hit in order to save money. Soon the company began closing its stores, not just any store, but major ones in the heart of Silicon Valley. The Palo Alto store closed in December of 2019, and the Campbell store was abruptly closed just last November. Over the years, we've lost Radio Shack, Toys R Us, the Shopper Image, and Brookstone, the Bose stores, Circuit City, and the Microsoft store, and more. In the Silicon Valley, they also lost CompUSA and Microcenter. Well, Microcenter still has stores outside of the Bay Area. I wonder how confident you are. Verizon tells its customers to turn off 5G to preserve battery life. Wait a minute, I bought 5G for a reason. In an effort to be helpful, Verizon accidentally stuck its foot in its mouth on Sunday and then furiously backtracked. In a tweet on Sunday, Verizon Wireless customer service told customers that if they were experiencing more battery drain than usual, they should just turn on LTE. The implication in this tweet directs customers to turn off 5G in phones that have it. Considering Verizon's big push into 5G, this seems contrary to all that hype. Verizon wrote in the tweet, "Are you noticing that your battery life is draining faster than normal? One way to help conserve battery life is to turn on LTE. Oh, what the heck did I pay for then? Well, to do it, they say just go to Cellular, Cellular Data Options, Voice and Data, and tap on LTE. A user on Twitter pointed out this irony. Verizon replied to the user, but didn't really address its previous battery advice, choosing instead to talk about 5G speeds. The original tweet about preserving battery life by switching to LTE has since been deleted. Verizon was asked for clarification on whether it was really telling customers to turn off their 5G to preserve battery life. In other words, if you have the option to use 5G, well, if you got a battery issue, don't use 5G. 5G could very well be the cause of the battery drain for some phones. Many new features and tech don't work as envisioned at first, which is logical. Besides, 5G is a work in progress in the United States. Addressing this in a roundabout way is a kind of a marketing spin. Sure, If Verizon came out and flat out said 5G could be the cause of the battery drain, some people might get outright upset, which is also understandable given all the fanfare around 5G. But at least it'll be the truth. Some companies have addressed this issue without creating a press relation problem. Samsung, for instance, dedicated a support page to the issue of battery drains on 5G service. The manufacturer acknowledged that this problem was legitimate and explained that it was due to a limitation of current 5G networks. But this would improve as 5G networks expand. Huawei also addressed the issue on a support page, stating that on a 5G network, more bandwidth is consumed online, and therefore more power may be consumed. Will 5G ever live up to this hype? Smartphones are being released with 5G, and carriers are now offering 5G. So why isn't everyone happy and wowed by it? 2 years after U.S. carriers began deploying commercial 5G, the networks are still a far cry from what companies have promised. The best 5G experiences are mainly found in locations meant for large audiences, like stadiums and concert venues. In other words, in open areas. The more basic nationwide 5G has broader availability, but limited advantages in speed and lag times relative to 4G connections. Unlike with 4G networks, there are many flavors or implementations of 5G that spans three different spectrums. Within each spectrum, there are multiple frequencies. The result is not what was hyped. With 5G, it's the carrier's ability to make money off of 5G, which means requiring pushing consumers to pricier plans with unlimited data. When people can spend more time out of the house, well, 5G networks could show some improvements as the carriers upgrade their network infrastructure. Midband is the critical factor that's been missing in the U.S. 5G networks, as it will allow carriers to build out networks that offer better service in more areas beyond the limited dense environments where carriers have deployed their best 5G experiences. These frequencies were just recently auctioned off to the carriers. Improvements to U.S. 5G networks are important because device makers are ramping up their efforts to get 5G handsets to consumers. Over the next year, carriers and consumers will both need to focus on whether their phones and other cellular devices are capable of tuning in low, mid, and high band 5G. Extending the analogy above, users may be unpleasantly surprised to discover that their pocket TVs aren't capable of receiving the 5G signals that they need for 3D videos, or can't acquire 5G signals in their homes. Some carriers will make this easier to figure out than others, and if not properly addressed, it may prove to be one of the biggest sources of 5G consumer complaints. There is no single new technology that defines 5G. Instead, the advantage of 5G comes from the variety of core network innovations, ear interface innovations, and the use of new spectrum. Many believe that 5G is one type of deployment with one range of performance. Truth is, besides the usual distance and object interference factors, the spectrum band that 5G is deployed with is the greatest determinant of performance. When 5G is deployed in the high spectrum band, that's a millimeter wave, performance will be extremely fast, 300 megabits to 3 gigabits per second download speeds. When deployed on lower bands of below 2 gigahertz, which is the current cellular spectrum, download speeds would be similar to 4G LTE and gigabit class LTE speeds. In the mid bands, that's the 2 GHz to the 6 GHz spectrum, 5G speed will be between 100 megabits and 1.5 gigabits per second. Across the globe, network operators have chosen to deploy the 5G standard with one of the spectrum bands, depending on their spectrum ownership and market strategies. Some operators are able to deploy across multiple spectrum bands. 5G can be deployed with different spectrum bands, and for each spectrum band, there is an inverse relationship between performance and propagation, meaning the extent that a radio wave will travel or penetrate objects. Spectrum bands with high propagation have low performance characteristics, while spectrum bands with low propagation have higher performance characteristics. To be more specific, the high spectrum millimeter wave band has high data capacity, but it must be in the line of sight or use reflections and have practical transmission limits of less than a kilometer. Adverse weather may also negatively affect millimeter wave transmission. Low spectrum bands have high propagation properties, with radio waves traveling up to 50 kilometers between towers, but have low data capacity. Many consider the mid-band the sweet spot that mitigates the propagation performance trade-off. Overall, 5G will not replace 4G. In fact, 4G LTE is the foundational technology of 5G. For the initial 5G deployments, modems will maintain two connections, 5G and 4G LTE, which includes gigabit class LTE. If a 5G signal weakens, traffic automatically flows through to the LTE connection. So far, 5G has been hyped as a cellular generation that will make virtual reality and augmented reality mobile and will usher in an era of self-driving vehicles. While that may be true, 5G's greatest opportunity likely will be for businesses. For the home consumer, it's all hype right now. T-Mobile data breach exposes highly sensitive information for some customers. This incident affected about 400 T-Mobile customers. The attacker or attackers seem to have penetrated T-Mobile systems with the goal of taking over customer accounts. But the intrusion is said to be over and affected customers have been notified. T-Mobile has disclosed a data breach after a number of customers were apparently affected by SIM swap attack. SIM swap fraud or SWIM hijacking allows scammers to take control of targets' phone numbers after porting them using social engineering or after bribing mobile operator employees to a SIM control by the fraudsters. Subsequently, they receive the victim's messages and calls, which allows them to easily bypass SMS-based multi-factor authentication, stealing user credentials, as well as taking over the victim's online service accounts. The criminals can then log into the victim's bank accounts to steal money, change account passwords, and even locking the victims out of their own accounts. Unlike the previous set of T-Mobile account compromises disclosed in late December, this is a more serious problem because it involves your full name and address, account number, social security number, customer account personal information number such as your PIN, account security questions and answers and date of birth. T-Mobile said an unknown attacker apparently used this information to port a victim's line to a different carrier without authorization. T-Mobile identified this activity, terminated the unauthorized access, and implemented measures to protect against reoccurrence. Ported or SIM swap numbers are serious enough as they can be leveraged to hijack other accounts or steal cryptocurrency. But you could do more than steal a phone number with the information exposed in these apparent account compromises. T-Mobile customers who received the letters pertaining to this most recent incident or series of incidents will be entitled to 2 years of free credit monitoring and identity theft protection provided by TransUnion. They are also being asked to change their account PINs and the account security questions and answers. Worried customers can call T-Mobile by dialing 611 from their T-Mobile phones or 1-800-937-8997 from any phone. This is the fifth data breach disclosed by T-Mobile during the last 4 years, all of them being reported after hackers gain access to customers' data. T-Mobile previously suffered from breaches in 2018 when millions of customers' info was accessed by hackers and in 2019 after exposing prepaid customers' data. Last year, the companies disclosed two more breaches, one of them in March of 2020 when attackers gained access to customer employee data. In December of last year, T-Mobile suffered another data breach after unknown threat actors again accessed customers' phone numbers and call records. Microsoft is removing Windows 10's 3D Objects folder. Remember when Microsoft was obsessed with adding 3D features to Windows 10? From Paint 3D to 3D effects in the photo app? It was endless. The 3D Objects folder is an artifact from those days, and Microsoft is finally getting rid of it. Well, not quite. Whenever you open File Explorer on Windows 10, the 3D Objects folder is front and center. But how many people use it? Almost no one that I know of. That's why, for many, it's one of the many useless features that Microsoft needs to remove from Windows 10. Someone in Microsoft must be listening. Last week, Microsoft announced the 3D Objects folder will be hidden from File Explorer. So it's not quite eliminating it, but just hiding it. This change is part of the insiders' builds of Windows 10's 21H2 update, which means it'll be coming up later in the year, which we expect will be released in winter of 2021. The 3D Objects folder isn't technically going away. It's just being hidden. You can still find it in your user account folder. In other words, if your user account is named owner, you'll find it in /users/owner/3D Objects. However, it's being removed from its top tier position with all the other important folders you see every time you launch File Explorer. If you never touch a 3D Objects folder, it's just an empty, hidden folder that you'll never have to see again. The Federal Communications Commission approves of a $50 monthly high-speed internet subsidy. The money, aimed at low-income households, is part of an effort to bridge the access gap to broadband connectivity amid the pandemic. The Federal Communications Commission on Thursday approved an emergency subsidy for low-income households to get high-speed internet, an effort to bridge the digital divide that has cut off many Americans from online communications during the pandemic. The four-member commission unanimously agreed to offer up to $50 a month to low-income households and up to $75 a month to households on Native American land for broadband service. The FCC will also provide a one-time discount of up to $100 on a computer or tablet for eligible homes. The program will use $3.2 billion that was allocated late last year by Congress as part of its COVID-19 relief bill to bring internet service to American families for distance learning, work, and digital health care. The program will be available within 60 days, said Jessica Rosenworcel, the acting chairwoman of the FCC. The agency still needs to sign up willing internet service providers and set up a program to approve and track recipients. At least 14.5 million Americans, according to the FCC report, do not have broadband. Over the past year, the digital divide has taken on greater urgency. This is a program that will help those at risk of digital disconnection, Ms. Rosenworcel said in a statement. It will help those sitting in cars in parking lots just to catch a Wi-Fi signal to go online for work. It will help those lingering outside the library with a laptop just to get a wireless signal for remote learning. Eligible recipients include families with children on free or reduced lunch programs, Pell Grant recipients, and individuals who have lost jobs or seen their income fall in the past year. The digital divide has been among the most persistent problems for telecommunications policymakers. More than $8 billion in federal funding is allocated each year to the problem. Much of that is allocated to internet service providers to bring service to rural and other underserved areas. There are many challenges. Broadband maps, for instance, notoriously overcount how many households have access. If an internet service provider such as Charter or AT&T reaches just one home in a census block, the entire block appears connected on federal maps, even when all homes aren't given the option of broadband. Ms. Rosenworcel announced the formation of a task force to study the agency's tracking of broadband access data. I hope they don't spend a lifetime doing this study. Microsoft is trying something different to prevent Windows 10 updates from failing. Upgrading Windows 10 to a new build is about to change. If you ever had Windows 10 update fail to install through no direct fault of yours, well, it shouldn't happen again, at least in theory. That's because Microsoft is making a key change in how it pushes out cumulative updates. More specifically, Microsoft is bundling something called a Service Stack Update, SSU, with regularly scheduled cumulative updates, starting with the one due out on March the 9th. For those familiar with Windows XP and Windows 7, they were called System Service Packs. Cumulative updates and SSUs are two separate beasts, up to this point. They have been doled out separately, the former on the second Tuesday of every month, otherwise known as Patch Tuesday, and the latter whenever Microsoft sees fit. Patch Tuesday was really patching the onion. In other words, just add another layer to it. If there's a problem, add another layer to it, and it builds up. Why does this matter? SSU, or the Service Stack Updates, tweak the actual update component in Windows and can fix issues that might prevent a patch from installing on your PC. Part of the reason is Microsoft doesn't issue SSUs on a monthly basis, and that can be a problem if a particular SSU is a prerequisite to install a particular cumulative update. That said, there's one final standalone SSU available, KB4598481. I'll repeat that again, KB4598481, which you can download separately, which paves the way for having future ones bundled. This update makes quality improvements to the servicing stack, which is the component that installs Windows updates. Servicing stack updates make sure that you have a robust and reliable servicing stack so that your devices can receive and install Windows updates. You can download KB4598481 manually. If Microsoft has not already pushed it out to your PC, and in fact, if you attempted to install last week's optional preview of this month's Patch Tuesday update, and it didn't take, this could be the reason why. Starting with this release, Microsoft will combine the latest Servicing Stack Update, SSU, for your operating system with the latest Cumulative Update, LCU. To utilize this improvement, install the most recent standalone update. Again, I repeat, KB4598481, before installing this LSU. If you install this LSU before installing KB4598841, you might encounter an error. In a class action lawsuit, the judge approves of $650 million Facebook fine for a privacy lawsuit settlement. A federal judge on Friday approved a $650 million settlement of a privacy lawsuit against Facebook for allegedly using photo, face tagging, and other biometric data without the permission of its users. U.S. District Judge James Donato approved a deal in a class action lawsuit that was filed in Illinois in 2015. Nearly 1.6 million Facebook users in Illinois who submitted claims will be affected. Donato called it one of the largest settlements ever for a privacy violation. It will put at least $345 into the hands of every class member interested in being compensated, he wrote, calling it a major win for consumers in the hotly contested area of digital privacy. Jay Edelson, a Chicago attorney who filed the lawsuit, told the Chicago Tribune that the checks could be in the mail within 2 months unless the ruling is appealed. Facebook, which is headquartered in the San Francisco area, said in a statement that they were pleased to have reached a settlement so that they can move past this matter, which is in the best interest of the community and the shareholders. The lawsuit accused the social media giant of violating an Illinois privacy law by failing to get consent before using facial recognition technology to scan photos uploaded by users to create and store faces digitally. The state's Biometric Information Privacy Act allowed consumers to sue companies that didn't get permission before harvesting data such as faces and fingerprints. The case eventually wound up as a class action lawsuit in California. Facebook has since changed its photo tagging system. The following is an editorial postscript. Facebook reported 2020 revenue of $86 billion, and when you look at that $650 million, less than 1% of 1% of their total revenues. In other words, it was just the cost of doing business. It's a slap on the wrist. This is cheap for Apple. Presenting IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell with Applicant Tracking System.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we set aside a little bit of time to talk about the business world and what is going on there in regards to information technology, or how information technology is leveraged. In this case, I want to talk about something called applicant tracking software. Now, this applicant tracking software system is all about utilizing technology in the recruitment area of any business. Now, what they're doing is they're trying to make the end-to-end process of hiring a lot easier. These were originally developed for large corporations that dealt with thousands and thousands of job applications all the time. So they wanted to sort out everybody who was applying for a job. You apply for a job and they're going to go ahead and they're going to read your resume. And they're going to be looking for certain keywords. And then they're going to read the next resume and the next resume. And they're going to look for all of these different things. And they're doing kind of this assembly of all of your resume information into kind of like a web page. And then when they need somebody, they then Google the various web pages and they look for the most hits for the particular job that they're looking to fill. So if you are a specialist in a certain field, let's say you're a specialist in Linux and you have a number of these different things, you're working with Oracle Linux, you've got familiarity with Oracle 7 Linux, and all of these different things. And we go all the way down this list of things that are job requirements. If you match all the way across the board, you get selected out. And they're going to select out everybody who matches up the most amount of items in their resume to what the job has. This is where it gets tricky. You're trying to target a particular role. You may have many years of experience. But your years of experience in that particular field may not come to light because of the fact that the systems are not perfect. They don't look for variations in terms. They don't look for all of the different options that could be out there. For instance, all right, I have experience in Microsoft Office for many, many years. So if I write in Microsoft Office, that's fine. But if they're looking for Office 365, not Microsoft Office 365, just Office 365, and I say I have experience with Microsoft Office across the entire history of Microsoft Office, all of a sudden, I'm no longer being selected as highly as somebody who specifically says Office 365. So what do I do here? Do I say Office 365? Well, okay, that helps. But then what if it's somebody who has, let's say, Office 2016 that they're looking for. See, this starts to get very tricky. They're looking to fill the numbers. They're looking for the person who hits highest amongst all of the scoring. And here's where it gets tricky. It's a computer alone that's doing this. It's a computer that's deciding to accept or reject your job application. And this keeps going further and further and further along, because now we do have a number of different organizations that have gotten together and they've developed neat little ideas, neat little programs that will interview you. Yes, you're being interviewed, an electronic interview, and there are a number of different companies that are doing these. Your interview may be a series of different questions which you think are kind of not really having to do with the job at hand. I've done a number of these. They are IQ tests, not called IQ tests, but they're IQ tests. They are personality tests. Except a computer is trying to determine your personality? Yes, they're even looking at the video that you might take. You may take a video interview. I was really, really surprised at the idea of the last time I was job hunting. I was sent to go take an interview. They're not going to ask me questions. The computer is going to ask me questions. That was creepy. Except the computer converts everything I say into text. And then it looks for things like, do I use the word I instead of we? Or maybe I use we instead of I. They're looking for a go-getter. They want somebody who's powerful, so they want the word I in there. They want a teammate. They want somebody who gets along and fits in, so they're looking for we. Wow. Yeah, so there is no right or wrong answer, and they say so. But the reality is there is, because for every job, there is going to be unspecified criteria which they're going to test you against. This is going to continue, and this is going to continue to get very difficult for all job hunters, for everybody who's looking for a job, and it's going to be based on a computer. Not based on your abilities, your knowledge, or even your personality. This is going to be kind of rough. This is not a future that I am really looking forward to. But then again, that's just me, a computer nerd. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Last week, the Perseverance landed on Mars. Well, that was quite exciting to see. But I didn't realize that there was a secret message on the parachute that Perseverance used to land. The parachute that helped carry NASA's Perseverance rover to the surface of Mars last week featured a hidden message, and space fans have managed to decode it. During a press conference earlier this week, NASA released breathtaking footage of its spacecraft carrying the car-sized rover toward the Martian surface. Upon facing cameras on the spacecraft's descent stage showed the deployment of the parachute, which at first glance appeared to display nothing more than a simple red and white design. But during Monday's news briefing, Alan Chen said that the entry, descent, and landing lead for the mission confirmed that there was actually a hidden message in the pattern and challenged space fans to work it out on what it said. Chen said space scientists are already keen to inspire others to enter the field, adding that for that purpose, we sometimes leave messages in our work for others to find. So they invited you to give it a shot and show your work. However, it wasn't very long before enthusiastic codebreakers started posting the answer online. It turns out the message was written in a binary computer code. Well, I'm not going to tell you what it was. You can look it up or try to figure it out. It's a message written in binary. Postscript. NASA must be operating on a very tight budget. When the Perseverance rover of NASA led itself to the surface of Mars on February 18th, it did so through the help of the same processor that operated the iMac G3 in the late 1990s. Do you have any spare money to support NASA? With desktop operating systems, there's Windows, Mac OS, Chrome OS, and the minions of fork and branches of GNU Linux. As we move to cloud-based desktop as a service, it shouldn't come as a surprise to see Chrome OS become Microsoft Windows' top competitor. According to IDC's latest PC sales numbers, by 2020's fourth quarter, Chromebooks were outselling Macs by 2-1. In the fourth quarter of last year, Windows had 76.7% of the market, Mac OS had 7.7%, and Chrome OS had 14.4%. For the year 2020, year over year compared to 2019, Windows lost 4.9 percentage points from 85.4% to 80.5%. Mac OS was up 0.8 percentage points from 6.7 to 7.5, and Chrome OS firmly in second place by jumping 4.4 points from 6.4 to 10.8%. In the analysis of the 2020 personal computer device market, Chromebook vendors' overall market almost quadrupled in size over the same period a year earlier. 2020 was the year where almost all school kids went to school virtually via Chromebooks. With many countries being forced to accelerate their digital education plans in the wake of additional lockdowns, schools and universities are clamoring for easy-to-deploy solutions, and Google's digital offerings for education are proving quite popular over rival platforms, especially in the United States and Western Europe. So a question that's being asked is Chrome OS Linux? Chrome OS is nothing much but the Chrome browser running on top of the Linux kernel. Chrome itself is based on the open-source Chromium browser, also from Google. Both Mac OS, the operating system, used on the Apple desktop and notebook computers, and Linux are based on the Unix operating system, which was developed at Bell Labs in 1969. The operating system used on Apple's iPhones, now called iOS, is derived from Mac OS, and therefore is also a Unix variant. Linux include many releases, such as Android, Arch Linux, Debian Linux, Gentoo Linux, Kubuntu, Mandriva Linux, PC Linux, Red Hat Linux, Sabayan Linux, Slackware, and I can go on and on. The official name for Linux distro is really GNU Linux. GNU? GNU means GNU, not Unix. The kernel of GNU Linux is Linux. It is the portion of the operating system code that is always resident in memory and facilitates interactions between hardware and software components. GNU is made up of utilities that are the basic file, shell, and text manipulation utilities of the operating system. These are the core utilities which are expected to exist on every operating system. Technically, the Chrome operating system is not based on a fork or branch of the GNU Linux operating system. But remember, you don't select the operating system and then ask what applications are available that meets your individual needs. You ask what operating system supports the application I want to run to meet my needs. If all things are equal, then you base your decision on an operating system based on available support. This is analogous to selecting an all-electric automobile and expect global service support anywhere in the country. No, it's the other way around. Presenting All Hands on Tech with Marty Winston. Bye bye buying. The world of shopping in stores and online has been bent out of shape, as many other aspects of life. Marty looks at both the immediate and the long-term impact of that.
Let's say there's something you need. Candy bar or a whole box of chocolates, new shoes, an umbrella. when that kind of need for some kind of something happened 5 years ago, how did you fulfill it? What did you do to get that thing you needed? Where did you go? 5 years ago, how much of your shopping meant you going to a store? How much was online? Today, how many of those stores are still open? How many of those stores have you visited, actually been inside in the past year? How about the past 6 months? In the past year, how many times have you shopped online? Hang in there, this is all leading to something. Roughly, what percentage of your online shopping involved Amazon? And who else? QVC? Let's take another cut at this. When's the last time you bought a candy bar, a box of chocolates, new shoes, an umbrella? If you needed these now, where would you go? For a candy bar, for a box of chocolates, for new shoes, for an umbrella. Are you going to stores like Target or Walmart more or less than you did 5 years ago? Are your grocery trips, assuming you don't have all your groceries delivered, are you making mostly major trips to buy 1 or 2 weeks' worth of groceries all at once, or mostly minor trips for just a few things, meaning you'll be making those trips a little more often? How much of your shopping gets bought on credit cards? How much on debit cards? How much with cash? How much with checks? Remember, these reports are anchored on hands-on technology, and the shifts have been significant where the technologies of shopping encounter a pandemic-altered world. Some of those shifts are likely to be long-lasting, others more temporary. But your own experience is the best possible starting point. Other than a lot of the stores you used to frequent no longer being around, your contemporary shopping rituals are also in response to other factors, like your starting point. If you had been working downtown and driving there every day, then shopping downtown or at stores en route would have been pretty convenient. But these days, you're probably not downtown every day. So which stores are no longer visible from your car window every day? Are you careful about contagion, wearing that mask, covering your nose, keeping those 6-foot bubbles between you and others? If you're one of the careful ones, then being around those who aren't as careful can be worrying, even disconcerting. By now, you've no doubt developed impressions of which stores worry you less and which worry you more, and if there are certain times of day that make those worries increase or decrease. Logically, you might think that the most likely places to find most people shopping are Target or Walmart and a grocery store and a pharmacy and Home Depot or Lowe's and Amazon. But we're all social animals, human, social, human animals. We all want to get out of the house, if even for a moment. At mealtimes, it's hard not to find cars lined up at fast food chains. There aren't many donut shops or gas stations that are absent lines in the morning. Places like Starbucks and Panera see lots of people all day. One more observation before we connect some dots on conclusions. Can you remember how much you paid for toilet paper in 2019? In 2020? Now? From coast to coast, our perception of value has shifted, and convenience is playing a bigger role than price. Amazon is booming, often because it's an easier way to find something close to what you're trying to get than it is to find a nearby store that might have it. Many people shop at stores less because homeschooling shackles them to inside the house. But all this working at home has also dramatically changed the list of things we frequently buy. Sweatshirts and pullovers are the new business casual, and it's hard to find anybody wearing a tie. Shoe shines don't get a high priority when so many people are in slippers or socks or barefoot. But the pandemic aside, there are some elements to these patterns that are shifting the entire context of buying. One is the overall willingness to be less selective, less finicky about what you buy to satisfy a specific and immediate need. When shoppers are willing to take what's offered even when stores offer less, stores will see that as an opportunity to stock fewer items, a lesser variety of goods, fewer brands, fewer sizes, a little less like a supermarket, a little more like a convenience store. Another is an accelerated movement to doing more shopping with debit cards, less with credit cards, less with checks, and less than before with cash. If you think about it, there are a lot of secondary benefits to that. For example, if you lose a debit card, you can disable it. But if you lose a roll of bills, there's no undo to that. How often are you getting your hair cut or styled? How often are you getting a manicure? The shops that perform these services today are taking effective precautions, but their customer visits are still way down. It isn't because there's anything less effective about these services. It's because their customers feel less exposed to other people, and they rationalize delaying any next visit. Computer-level consumer high-tech has been with us for half a century, so we're all accustomed to craving the latest and greatest state-of-the-art, right? But lately, those haven't felt nearly as compelling. Those urges, not strong. How eager are you to upgrade your TV? Anything about your computer that makes you feel an urgent need to replace it? How's your car? The era of the consumed consumer is taking a break. Here's what's likely to follow and how buying is likely to change. Any product that's not an absolute necessity will have to earn your interest in it. For sellers, the greatest challenge to gaining that purchase is the competitor that's never in the comparison chart. Nothing. Nothing is an option for every buyer. Don't buy now, buy nothing. A lot of people seem to forget that buying nothing or nothing new remains not only a choice, but also, especially in times like these, a highly preferable choice. Those sellers will need new skill sets. They will need to learn how to compete against the idea that you don't really need them. At the same time, there's the awkward business of convincing you that you don't really want to buy any of their competitors either. So a lot of it comes down to an entirely different scope of information. Feeds and speeds can hit the weeds. They will need to manifest exactly what dramatic improvement comes to your life when you own their whatever. None of it's about them. It's all about you. And they're the ones with the burden of proof. If they succeed, it won't much matter where or how you buy that stuff, only if you do or don't. The marketplace shifts from hustling to more fundamental appeals. Thanks to the pandemic, buying won't be what it was before. To be frank, a lot of what it was before was an addiction. Some of that may come back, but for the moment, so has a lot of purchasers' decision-making and control. Next time, given all the time we've spent on air disinfection using UVC and other technologies, it's time to take a look at a non-electronic approach to surface disinfection. You'll learn about one service that uses a more-than-chemical spray with a lingering effect. Be here for coronavirus chemical warfare. Even the Geneva Convention will welcome it.
Thank you, Marty. Coming up March the 20th, the 45th Trenton Computer Festival. It is the original personal computer festival. The Trenton Computer Festival, TCF, was created back in 1976 as an annual educational event with speakers, forums, and user group meetings, and exhibit area, as well as an outdoor flea market. But with the pandemic, all that got changed. TCF 2021 will be held as a virtual event on Saturday, March the 20th, 2021. It will be a full day of learning and fun. TCF21 is free via Zoom teleconferencing to all. Donations will be welcome and accepted to offset expenses. All you need is a personal computing device, like a personal computer, a tablet, and maybe perhaps a little difficulty, even a smartphone. The TCF keynote speaker will be Jerry Foster, and he will be talking about how I learned to stop worrying and love artificial intelligence. He is the CTO and co-founder of Plex Systems. This keynote provides an overview of artificial intelligence from its humble beginnings to disruptive force, with an eye towards the significant positive impact on our world. The website for the festival is tcf-nj.org for more information. Public service announcements. Computer Club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Most of the computer clubs have begun to schedule their general monthly meetings through teleconferencing. For updated information, visit the website of the Computer Club. The Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation focused on digital cameras. Thursday, March the 4th, 2021, meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting. Their website is wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey, their meeting is March the 5th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. via Jitsi Meet, and their website is acgnj.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a meeting on Thursday, March the 11th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and the website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, March the 12th, 2001, 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and their website is limac.org. Brookdale Computer Users Group meets Thursday, March the 25th, 2021. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. via Zoom. Their website is pcug.com. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.